Thinking Aloud from the University of Warwick.
Hello and welcome to Thinking Aloud. I'm Stephen Bates, a PhD researcher in the History Department here at Warwick, and with me is Professor John Stiles of the University of Hertfordshire. Formerly the head of graduate studies at the Victoria and Albert Museum, Professor Stiles has published on the dress of the common people, everyday fashion in 18th century England, and is currently involved in Threads of Feeling, an exhibition of the textiles preserved in London's Foundling Hospital, founded by Thomas Coram in 1739. Professor Stiles, I wonder if I can ask you first to tell us a little about the Threads of Feeling exhibition.
Well, it's an exhibition of mid-18th century textiles, which I discovered when I was doing my book, Dress of the People. I spent many years teaching design history, and I always used to tell my design history students that it was crucial that they use objects as evidence as well as texts, and that they actually develop arguments from the objects. So here I was doing a book about ordinary people's clothes, which should have been based on objects, but of course none of those clothes survive because they were all worn to rags. They do survive in one form, which is as books in the British Library, because the rags were then converted into paper, because before the mid-19th century there was no pulp paper, it was all made from rags. But that wasn't much use to me as a historian of clothing. But then I remembered that I'd read articles about children's clothing, which referred to surviving examples of children's clothing in the collections of the Foundling Hospital from the mid-18th century. So I went off to the London Metropolitan Archives to look at these things and found not just items of children's clothing, but more interestingly for me, vast numbers, altogether about 5,000 examples of textiles of various kinds that had been left with the babies as identifiers, essentially. The Foundling Hospital took in the babies anonymously. They didn't record the mothers' names. But they retained the idea that if the mother's circumstances changed, they should be able to come back and reclaim the babies. And so they needed some form of identifier that could link mother and baby when a baby who'd been left at the age of 1 day, 1 week, 1 month was 4, 5, 6 years old and therefore difficult to identify as the original child. And they used textiles to do this. And so almost serendipitously we end up with this vast collection of textiles, which are beautiful, poignant, because they represent a relationship between mother and child sundered, and also academically interesting, not least because most of them date from the 1740s and 50s, the decades just before the beginning of the classic Industrial Revolution, Hargreaves spinning jenny, Arkwright's spinning frame, all of the 1760s, the subsequent decade. So in all sorts of ways, these are fascinating objects, and I thought these are going to be fascinating not just to historians or textile buffs, but potentially interesting to the general public. And so it's proved that the exhibition has been terrifically successful. I'm blue-eyed boy at the Foundling Museum currently. It won't last forever. But it's been wonderful watching the public come into their relatively small exhibition space and yet spend sometimes hours looking closely at these things, sometimes in tears, finding them very moving and always finding them a source of great fascination. So for someone who's trained as a historian and has worked principally as a historian writing books and articles and the like, it is rather wonderful to actually see one's work out there face-to-face with the general public, something which I think many of us hope to do, but it's often hard when you're ensconced in a university.
And the Foundling textiles are obviously, as you say, remarkably poignant pieces, and when you think about their origins, quite heart-wrenching. Would you say they constitute your favourite primary source?
At the moment, yes, they are my favourite primary source, because although I first worked on them 4 or 5 years ago, I'm still finding new ways to use them. So, for instance, I'm starting a new project on the history of spinning before the Industrial Revolution. It's called Spinning in the Era of the Spinning Wheel. And the spinning wheel came to Europe in the late Middle Ages and then, of course, is driven out of general use by the new inventions of the Industrial Revolution. So I'm looking at that long period when the spinning wheel prevailed. And as part of this, I've just bought a new toy, which is a USB microscope. This is a microscope that you link into your computer, and you can then bring up at 200 times magnification an object on the computer screen that you're, as it were, looking at through the microscope. And I've been doing a lot of work on the Foundling textiles with this. So this is my latest use of them, to actually look at what these fabrics that ordinary, mainly young women and their babies, wore, were actually made of in terms of the physical composition, whether it's linen or cotton or woolen or whatever. So I've found this a source that goes on providing new kinds of insights into the history of the period. And I'm doing it in ways that even a couple of years ago I would never have imagined. So it is a wonderful source. It's really the material culture historian's holy grail. Because what you have here are thousands and thousands of objects which we know passed through the hands of very ordinary young women. However, they were actually acquired at the second hand or gifts or whatever. We know that the young women clothed their babies in these things, and they actually must have passed through their hands. But what we also have, because of the efforts of the clerks of the Foundling Hospital, are descriptions of the objects. They actually name half the textiles. So for something like 2,000 to 2,500 textiles, we have the thing and we have the name. And that combination of material object and word is, I think, a material culture historian's holy grail.
I mean, it's a fascinating combination and opportunity to use these sources. Conversely, can we get your thinking on, perhaps briefly, about your favourite secondary source?
Well, let me mention two, and they're linked, and they overlap in a way. I think the book I've enjoyed and taken most from in the last 3 or 4 years is Jan de Vries's Industrious Revolution. And I like this book because it's ambitious, it's European-wide in scope, and it resolves a paradox, or it sets out to resolve the paradox. In my opinion, it does resolve it reasonably successfully. And the paradox is, why is it that when all the work that economic historians have done on real wage data suggests that people in Western Europe are getting poorer in the course of the long 18th century, all the work that historians have done on the things people own, on their material culture, suggests that they're getting better off in terms of the number and range of objects they have in their possession. And he resolves this paradox by arguing that women and children were drawn into waged work on an unprecedented scale by the attractiveness of the new sorts of goods that were becoming available in Western Europe in this period, which might be Indian cotton fabrics, or gin, or tea and coffee, or the new ceramics, often copying Chinese ceramics, and so on and so forth. And I think it's a very nice integration of, if you like, supply side and demand side economic history. And I think, although one always has reservations even about books one likes, I think there's a kernel of truth in his argument, which I find very convincing. The other book I should mention as something I like a lot is related. It's Hans-Joachim Voth's book on time and work in England in the late 18th and early 19th century. It too is concerned with how hard people worked during the Industrial Revolution and the great changing intensity of work and what drove people to work harder. But what I really like about this book and what I want to pick out is the way it uses evidence. What Voth did was to go through lots and lots of court records, particularly those from the Old Bailey, the Criminal Court of Old Bailey in London. And he did this before these records were available online, which they now are. So all strength to him. He must have taken a long, long time. But what he did was look at what time witnesses said they were working and at what time they said they were at leisure. Because very often in a criminal court then, as now, the witness will be asked to establish why they saw the crime, where they were, what they were doing, why they were there. And I think it's a very clever way of, in aggregate, establishing the way people spent their time in a city. I mean, he uses thousands and thousands and thousands of observations to generate a view of how time use changed decade by decade. And what I like about that, and books like that, and research of that kind, is the way that historians, at their most imaginative, will use a source that has to do with one thing, in this case, criminal offences, to draw very powerfully argued and effectively generated conclusions about something completely different. And I think that's one of the ways in which historians are at their most imaginative. I mean, history in the end is an empirical discipline. It involves an encounter between the empirical and the conceptual, always. And it behoves us to think about the most imaginative manner in which we can use and generate empirical evidence. And Voth, in this book, certainly did that.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Professor Stiles, for giving us your time today. And thank you for listening to Thinking Aloud.
Thinking Aloud, from the University of Warwick.